afternoon. You're tuned to Juno Afternoon here for Tuesday, the 8th of December, the year 2015. Jeff Brown with you here today. We'll get the details about tonight's Mudroom presentation. We'll talk with wearable arts artist Michelle Morris. Rosemary Walling will be here to highlight tonight's planetarium show on Christmas in Space. I'll talk with JDHS teacher and coach Leslie Knight about student activities with the Juno School District. That writer's almanac, Burnout Music and More today on a Juno Afternoon. Weather forecast for tonight, rain showers mixing with snow in the Mendenhall Valley. About 1 inch of snow expected. Low temperatures 32 to 36 degrees. Forecaster said Wednesday, rain showers, high temperatures around 38 degrees. Forecaster Thursday, partly cloudy skies with isolated rain showers and snow.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Supreme Court is reviewing a case involving the Mississippi Band of Choctaw Indians, which could have ramifications for tribes across the country. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington about the case being closely watched by Native leaders.
Ahead of the oral arguments, Native leaders made their presence known on the steps of the Supreme Court. The case the justices are weighing is Dollar General Corporation versus Mississippi Band of Choctaw Indians. Back in 2003, a young Native boy claimed he was sexually assaulted by a manager of Dollar General at one of their reservation stores. But the justices aren't considering the alleged crimes. They're weighing who has jurisdiction over the case, a tribal court or Mississippi courts. Carl Rogers is the lawyer for the tribal parties.
Well, it's a long, long road, and this is about jurisdiction. It's not about who wins in the court once it gets to a court. So there's a lot of steps between now and then.
Dollar General argues tribes don't have the authority to try non-natives who break the law in Indian country because tribal courts don't operate under the U.S. constitutional system. But Rogers contends tribes have sovereignty that predates the Constitution itself, and that's why the case is so major.
Well, it's going to lay out the contours for the scope of tribal civil jurisdiction, that's for sure. We don't know how extensive. We don't know if they'll find a way to a limited decision. We just don't know.
Lawyer Mary Catherine Nagel is a citizen of the Cherokee Nation. She co-wrote the amicus brief in the Dollar General case. She says she was disturbed by what she heard from the male Supreme Court justices during the oral arguments.
But, yeah, the idea that somehow our jury pools are incompetent or unable to fairly render justice, I don't know where that would come from except some archaic colonial prejudice that Indians are inferior.
Nagel says she doesn't believe the justices have a good understanding of how tribal courts operate.
The people who sit on tribal juries are citizens, and also a lot of tribal courts draw from members of the community. So if you're a spouse, you could be not enrolled in the tribe. You could be a French national living on the reservation, but you're married to a Mississippi Choctaw, and you could get called onto the court.
2 years ago, Congress updated the Violence Against Women Act and gave tribal courts the power to prosecute non-Native men who abused women in Indian country. Terry Henry is a co-chair of the National Congress of American Indians Task Force on Violence Against Native Women. She says the Dollar General case will have far-reaching implications outside of Mississippi.
What this case represents is an erosion of our tribal court's ability to issue civil protection orders, and that is how women are able to get a restraining order in an instance of domestic violence. And so we are here in support of the implications of the outcome of this case if it goes against tribes.
The justices will release their ruling before June. And neither side is making predictions on the contentious case that will be felt from coast to coast. I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Events continue this week in Paris by indigenous people who are voicing environmental protections as world leaders engage in climate talks. On Sunday, canoes took to the waters with the message to keep fossil fuels in the ground. On Monday, a youth-led concert was held to denounce RED, a carbon offset mechanism. Today, women with climate solutions are focusing on renewable energy and forests. Indigenous people from North America are among participants. Navajo leader Leonard Hosky has passed away. The former interim chairman and council delegate died Sunday at age 71 in New Mexico. He was well known for his knowledge of Navajo language and culture and had degrees in civil engineering and was a licensed engineer in 3 states. As a tribal leader, he's remembered for work on education and employment issues, as well as establishing a permanent fund. Flags on the Navajo Nation are at half staff in his honor through Friday. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation is accepting artwork and reservations for the Alaska Native Art Auction, taking place February 18, 2016 in Anchorage, Alaska. Over 400 business leaders and executives attend this annual event. Proceeds benefit Kiwanis News Programming. Learn more at knba.org.
Support by Indigenous Governance Programs at the University of Arizona, educating practitioners and policymakers to implement nation building at home and create stronger Native nations. Course offerings at igp.arizona.edu.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned in Juneau Afternoon. You're in listener-supported KTOO and KRNN-FM in Juneau. In the studio with me now, members of the Christian and Gospel group, This Hope. They're performing tonight at Centennial Hall, and they were here 3 years ago and brought the house down. Thank you for coming down the station.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Jeff.
So first of all, where did the name This Hope come from?
Well, it came from Hebrews 6:19, the passage in the Bible. It says, we have this hope as an anchor for the soul, firm and secure. And it was kind of a... Anyway, it came down to the fact that we couldn't decide on a good name, so we found this one and liked what it had to say. And it's a little bit obscure at times, but love the biblical meaning. So that's where it came from.
And you're all from Soldotna, pretty much.
Yeah, we all grew up basically in Soldotna and Soldotna and Kenai, and went to high school there. And yeah, it's great.
And you performed pretty much around the world.
All over the place. We've been all over the United States. I think in almost like 47 of the 50, something like that.
Yeah, I think there's two or three still to go.
Two or three left, and then been in Spain and Romania and the Canary Islands and Cuba and the Ukraine. And that's the ones I can remember.
How do the audiences differ?
Oh man. They differ drastically depending on where you are. Even in our country, it's very different. The Midwest would be a little more reserved, a little more subdued, and the Northeast would kind of fit into that category. Down in the South and Southwest, they're a little bit more rambunctious, which is a little more responsive, which is good. And up here in Alaska, we never know what we're going to get. So,
how'd the group get started?
You know what? My dad was a pastor in a church there in Soldotna, and Tim is in the band here with us, and Tim and I and Daniel, and we just started singing in church together, and, you know, they'd need special music on Sunday, and we started singing a cappella back in those days, and over time, other churches heard that we were singing some stuff, and so we'd come over and sing a couple songs there, and then they said, well, you should record something. And so we recorded something, and it was horrible. It really was. It was horrible. But, you know, it was. They liked it, and we kind of liked it. And then, you know, it just grew. And we did that for about 5 years. And then in 1996, we went full-time. And we've been doing it ever since then.
How did you get started?
Just singing in church.
Singing
in church, and just the demand from other churches inviting us, and it was kind of a, we really think it was a God thing, because, you know, five guys growing up here in out of the way Alaska, and what God put together up in Soldotna, the lower 48, and around the world, people really have enjoyed it, and they love the message.
I should have done this earlier, but if you could introduce yourselves and what role you play in this sound.
Hi, I'm Gene Bope. I sing baritone. We all kind of move around, and we all sing, but a couple of guys play too. I don't really play. I'm kind of a hack on instruments, so I mostly sing.
I'm David Abnett, and I sing second tenor primarily, and then play a little acoustic guitar.
My name is Micah Boudreaux, and I play keys and do a little bit of singing.
I'm Daniel Johnston, and I play bass and sing.
And I'm Tim Abnett, and I sing bass and play.
Do you define Christian music through the ears of This Hope?
Define Christian music.
Well, our music from the very beginning has always been centered around the church. And so the point of every song that we sing is proclaiming the gospel, Jesus Christ coming to save us from our self-inflicted sin. And so most of our songs reflect that. All of our songs reflect that. And so the point of our music has always been not just entertainment, but to encourage people, to sometimes convict people, just kind of a cross-section of what you would find in the Bible.
And the music, we sing all kinds of stuff because we're singing to, you know, 8-year-olds and 80-year-olds and churches that have very contemporary music and churches that are just like using organ. So we have a pretty broad variety because we really want to, you know, meet people where they are and sing at least something that just about everybody's going to like, at least some part of the concert. So we're going to sing some a cappella stuff, and we'll do that tonight. And we'll also sing some stuff that we play on and stuff, some tracks, some jazz, some barbershop, you know, close to barbershop stuff. So it's fun for just about anybody. You'll find something you'll like.
If you could talk about some notable Christian performers and how they've influenced your sound.
Well, we grew up listening to GLAAD, and they released an a cappella project when we were kind of in junior high school, with the group GLAAD, and then there was a group called A Cappella, the Gaither Vocal Band,
Take Six,
For Him,
Phil's Craig and
Dean. Those bands, you know, influenced us in one way or another. And we kind of have taken, I guess, if you go back 20 years, we've kind of taken bits and pieces of all of those things and molded and shaped them into what we do and put our own little twist on all of that. So unlike some of them, we're not exclusively a cappella, but then unlike others, we also do sing a cappella. So it's kind of a mix of styles.
I'm talking to members of the group This Hope. They're performing tonight at 6:30 at Centennial Hall. Could you describe a typical concert, if there's such thing as a typical concert?
Well, we're in the middle of Christmas tour right now, so this tonight's all Christmas the whole way. There's going to be a lot of a cappella, a lot of upbeat fun, songs that you know, arrangements of songs that you know, classic Christmas songs that you know, and then there's going to be some new stuff as well. So style wise, it's gonna go from jazz to country to a more adult contemporary.
Even a song with a little bit of rap in it.
Yeah. Even a song with some rap. There'll be some spoken word. It's a mix of styles, and it's all Christmas tonight. So celebration of Christ's birth and what that means, and a reason to be excited, and a reason to have hope, a reason for peace, a reason for joy. It's going to be a great night. It's going to be fun.
Do you find a special need for your music in these troubled times?
Everybody's in the middle of a storm of some kind. Our nation's in the middle of a storm. Our world is in the middle of a storm. And then all of us as individuals, we're just about everybody you talk to is working through something.
But you're doing something about it.
Well, what we're doing is proclaiming Christ to them and the hope that he brings. And there's nothing I can offer. There's nothing I can do to help anybody through a situation, but in Christ, there is hope, there is peace, there is joy, and there's a way through.
I'm imagining there's going to be some singing along. Is it you going to play traditional music tonight, or a mix of your own?
Yeah, there'll be a mix. Some stuff that everybody has heard, some stuff that's original as well, and then some stuff that people can sing along with.
What's the biggest crowd you've ever performed in front of?
We do quite a few conventions and conferences, those sorts of things. So some of those would be the biggest, like 10,000 would be the largest in a dome in Indianapolis. Probably was the largest.
That must bring about an amazing feeling.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of funny because the truth is I would rather sing to any place that's full and energetic. You know, I would love to sing to a room that seats 200 people and it's packed to the gills and everybody's into the concert. You know, sometimes it's not that great to sing in a room that seats, you know, 10,000 and there's 6,000 people there and it feels kind of empty and the energy is down. So it's kind of, More than the numbers, it's more about the room and the energy. We're looking forward to tonight. It was full. So come early tonight because it was full last time, and we're looking forward to it again. It was a great concert when we were here last time.
Now, were you playing in Los Angeles last night? Because I saw a picture taken out of an airplane window.
Oh, Los Angeles?
No, actually, that was a middle-of-the-night layover.
Yeah. we were in Atlanta. We came from Atlanta yesterday. We've been singing kind of in the Midwest, Missouri and Ohio into Kentucky in the last week. So.
All right, Nora, thank you, gentlemen, for coming by the station here. And you dropped off a CD, too, so who wants to talk about what we're going to hear next?
Yeah, so the song that you'll hear is off of our brand new Christmas EP, and it's the first track. It's called We Three Kings, Familiar Carol.
All right, have a good time. The concert starts at 6:30, but get there early tonight.
Sure, yeah.
Home.
Yep, we'd love to have you guys.
Thanks for coming by.
Thanks,
Jeff. Thank you.
Hope. They're performing tonight at 6:30 at Centennial Hall. It's a free concert, but donations are appreciated.
And here Here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 8th of December, 2015. It's the birthday of the novelist Richard Llewellyn, born in a suburb of London, 1906. Most famous for his first book, How Green Was My Valley, story of Hugh Morgan, a young man growing up in the mining town in South Wales in the 1890s. Llewellyn said it was based on his own life, but it turned out that he had been born and raised in England. It's the birthday of the novelist Mary Gordon, born Far Rockaway, New York, 1949, went off to Barnard, went to work on a PhD on Virginia Woolf, and reading Virginia Woolf inspired Mary Gordon to quit her dissertation and become a writer herself. Published many novels, stories, memoirs, essays, including Final Payments, The Company of Women, and most recently The Liar's Wife. It's the birthday of Eli Whitney, Westboro, Massachusetts, 1765, who invented the cotton gin, found a way to make a machine that would separate cotton seeds from fibers and produce up to 50 pounds of clean cotton each day. It revolutionized cotton farming in America. It's the birthday of James Thurber, Columbus, Ohio, 1894. Went to Ohio State University, dropped out of school, went to Paris for a while, returned to Columbus, worked as a reporter, then back to Paris, then back to New York, got a job at the New York Evening Post, and then at a party he met E.B. White, who introduced him to Harold Ross at the New Yorker, and James Thurber went to work there, and the rest is history. It's the birthday of the man who said, "Poetry is everywhere, it just needs editing." James Tate, born Kansas City in 1943. It's the birthday of Doris Bell Collier, 1897, Manchester, England. She was a physician. She was in private practice with her husband. And when she was 40 years old, her husband died in a car crash, leaving her with four children and very little money. Whereupon she turned to writing mysteries. She turned out one or two novels a year for the next 50 years, often taking on subjects like medical ethics and race relations, the role of women in medicine, but never forgetting that her readers expected a certain salacious element in everything she wrote. Here's a poem for today by Thomas Lux, entitled Regarding Most Songs, with a quotation from Joseph Addison, "Whatever is too stupid to say can be sung." The human voice can sing a vowel to break your heart. It trills a string of banal words, but your blood jumps regardless. You don't care about the words, but only how their song and the music behind, the brass, the drums. Oh, the primal, necessary drums behind the words, so dumb, that power, the bang and the boom, and again the bang, we cannot, need not live without, nor without other means to make sweet noise, the guitar or violin, the things that sing, the plaintive, joyful sounds. Which is why I like songs best when I can't hear the words, or better still, when there are no words at all. Regarding Most Songs, a poem by Thomas Lux, from The Street of Clocks, published by Houghton Mifflin Company, and used by permission here in the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving to calculate baseline scores. Learn more at lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Planetary Radio is Public Radio's only weekly series about space exploration. I'm Matt Kaplan. and I hope you'll join me as we explore Mars, look for life in the universe, and fly through the rings of Saturn. We'll talk with the men and women, scientists and dreamers who are guiding us to a future beyond Earth. And don't forget to enter our weekly space trivia contest. That's Planetary Radio.
Friday nights at 7:30 here on KTOO FM in Juneau.
The New Year's Eve Barnett's is always a fun and relaxed way to close out the year with friends and neighbors. The Taku Gales provide this year's live music, and Tom Paul will teach and call modern and classic contra and square dances. As always, you don't need experience or a partner. Join us New Year's Eve at St. Anne's Parish Hall downtown from 7:30 to 11 for a low-cost, high-fun evening out. Discounts for students and seniors free for AmeriCorps and JBs, sponsored by Juno Folk Dances with help from KTOO. It's the New Year's Eve Barn Dance.
It's 3:25 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juno. And also tuned in on KRNN FM in Juno. In the studio with me now, Amanda Compton and Kevin Crowley here to talk about tonight's Mudroom recording.
Hi, Dad.
Hello.
Thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having us.
So we ask this question every time somebody comes on from Mudrooms. Define Mudrooms, please.
Mudrooms is an event we have monthly, seasonally. It is seven storytellers from the community, or community at large, I should say, that come in and tell a story in 7 minutes on a particular theme. We get an audience between 150, 250 people. We charge, give or take, $7. All profits go to a particular charity. And so to define it, I guess, would be to say it's a way to connect people from our community to each other through little bits of their personal histories and current stories. And we actually have one of our storytellers for tonight. We're having our event tonight in the house with us right now, the room.
Yeah, and Carly, thank you for coming in.
Sure.
What story are you going to tell? And was it hard coming up with the story?
The theme of tonight is the kindness of strangers, and I've gone to this since I've lived here, basically almost 2 to 3 years, and so I was looking to do one. It was kind of like one of those bucket list things in Juneau, and I saw kindness of strangers, and a story immediately popped into my mind, and so I thought, well, you know, if I didn't have to think too hard about it, then maybe it's a good one.
Did it come naturally for you, or did you have to work at it?
The telling of the story, or the story itself? Well,
it's the story from beginning. Idea to actually performing a story.
It came pretty easy. I guess I wrote it out just to make sure that I kind of had all my ideas down. And I think writing something versus telling something is very different. And so I tried to write it as if I was speaking it. But it came pretty naturally, just kind of going from memory.
That seems like one of the best ways. Like, I didn't mean to use the word best, because anything's great. But it seems like one of the ways that the stories go off most smoothly is to sort of have more of a speaking element. So people will write them out, but if you have an outline, or if, like Kevin said, he wrote it as if he was speaking, those are the ones that go over a little better. They're kind of like rehearsed dinner party stories, or if you're telling someone in the bus stop or in the grocery store, I can't believe this happened, and it may be an interesting story that's happened to you several times, and so you get better at honing it in, and the delivery at different dinner parties. It's like those stories versus like the campfire sort of ghost stories, or those sort of real life stories of mishaps and adventure, and in this case, kindness of strangers, that get worked on a little bit so they can be delivered in a strong way in 7 minutes, but that are also still raw. Like, we're not expecting it to be completely perfect. That seemed to go off the best.
What's the theme? Is the kindness of strangers? And what are the tellers going to be?
We have seven speakers tonight, and it was kind of a popular one. We still have alternates, so for some reason someone can't get there tonight. We've got a list of three alternates, but we've got Bob Coghill, Janelle Vondrashek, Phil Campbell is the pastor at the venue that we use, Kevin Crowley, Phoebe Rohrbacher. She's actually taking off from town, so this will be one of her last sort of public speaking events, and Tom Cosgrove, he's on our board member, he's one of our Mudrooms board members, and he's a very, very interesting and fun to listen, and Chris Knight. I would say positive things about every person on this list, except I don't know them all. That's why I qualified the ones that I did.
Chris Knight is just pledged during the membership drive. So thanks, Chris, for pledging.
Thanks, Chris. I also have his bio, so I can tell you a little bit about him.
Sure.
He's a fisherman, and I have to look it up. Busted.
All right. And the music. You have music.
We do. We have live music. And tonight we have Laura Chase playing. So probably around 6:30, which is when we recommend people getting there, because I know we filled the house last month and there was potentially a fire problem, which I probably shouldn't be broadcasting. But we're going to have to get there early and change seats around. So we do want people to get there early because we can't have big crowds like we did lingering in the wings. There are wings there. And get there at 6:30. Music's going to be there at 6:30. Laura Chase, she's going to play as well as at an intermission. So really excited to have her. I haven't met her. Haven't heard her play before. So I'm excited about that. We have room for music in our January event, too. January's event is Second Chances. And we're pretty much full with storytellers. We have one spot left. But we are looking for music.
How many times have you had to use alternates?
Never. Although we always keep a list of alternates, so there has been one or two times where a week before an event, someone has to go take care of an emergency vet situation or fly out of town. Then we have used an alternate, but never the night of. But 4.5 years now, so it's bound to come up at some point.
Did you have any idea when you started this at the Rookery years ago that it was going to blossom into what you're presenting now?
I didn't. And I was very excited. I would say surprised, except the whole reason I started it is because I knew it was going to be such an awesome event. And so that it's took traction has been validating, but I think other people are also coming together to just share the same opinion I had. So, which is that an event structured like this could do really well here. So I'm really happy about it. But the momentum has come from a really incredible board, and other friends and board members have come together to make this happen. But it has been us combined with this reception in the community that's done so well. And I mean, community, the use of that word to me can be pretty overused and becomes pretty cliche. But I guess there's also a reason why things get cliche. And I think an event like this is a great reason to prove that. It is a community event. It really is. It builds community, whatever that phrase means to you. It does it. It really does it. You can see it at work here. And I think the structure and the individual relationship that each person has with the event. So when you go to this event and whatever speaker speaks to you, and if the music speaks to you or some things were touching or funny, like that's each person's own experience then. And I think that's what was so enticing about it.
Kevin, you wrote down your story getting, as if you're listening to or telling it in front of a bunch of people. How much did it change from the initial writing down till the polished performance we're going to see tonight?
I wouldn't say anything changed. You know, I'm not going to make anything up or invent anything. But the distilling of the story, I think, is where it changes. You know, I could probably spend 20 minutes telling the same story if I had the time. But picking out which details are the most important and what makes the story relate to the theme is one thing. But, you know, what makes it funny or what makes it relatable, I think in the distillation of it is where it changed. So I had to leave a lot of things out, and I had to pick and choose what were the most important things that I wanted to include for the 7 minutes that I have.
Listen to this guy. Don't you want to hear him tonight? I want to hear him. His voice is great. Come on down. 7 o'clock, Northern Light United Church is where we have it. 6:30, really.
And it costs $7 to get in, and you donate that to
CIRC. Yeah, it's all going to the Learning Center at CIRC, and it's our last night to support them. So if that is a nonprofit that adult education and continuing education classes are important to you, this is the last time to donate to them through us. So you could come down and give a $20 donation, or if you don't have $7, we still encourage you to come. There'll be cookies from the Rookery, there'll be coffee from Copa, and that's what I got.
And if you miss this opportunity to listen to this live, we broadcast the full show pretty much on the fourth Thursday of every month.
We do, yes. So you can see it online. You can see more information, like what events you might want to sign up for or attend at mudrooms.org.
Min Compton, Kevin Crowley, anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
No, just come at 6:30 tonight. That's all I can say.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Bird Note. By December, an extravagant array of diving birds that nested at far northern latitudes now bob on temperate waters across the continent. Loons, grebes, and ducks, goldeneyes, buffleheads, scoters, and mergansers float on the water's surface. Then they're lost to us as they disappear below. If we could watch them underwater, we'd see common loons racing like torpedoes, propelled by large feet set far to the rear of their bodies. Loons feed mostly within 20 feet of the surface, but can reach 200 feet and stay under for up to 3 minutes. Most diving ducks, though, are down and up again in less than a minute. Searching for food, they swim with their feet, sometimes using their canted wings to steer. A goldeneye dives under and swims about 10 feet from the surface, while scoters get down to 30 feet in search of clams and mussels. But if one bird stands out as the most beautiful diver, it has to be the long-tailed duck. Propelling itself beneath the surface with its wings, it seems to fly through the water, sometimes to depths of more than 60 feet. Today's Bird Note is brought to you by the Bobolink Foundation.
It's 37 minutes past the hour, and you're tuned to June afternoon. You're a listener-supported public media from Alaska's capital city. In the studio with me now are Nancy DeCherney and Michelle Morris here to talk about the Wearable Art Contest coming up in February. Michelle and Nancy, thank you for coming by the station today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
This is very exciting. Michelle is going to talk about her process on, you're going to enter this year.
Yeah, I've already submitted my application for this year.
People who want to apply, the deadline's coming up next week. It's on, you can go onto our website and fill out the stuff, sign up for your modeling thing. Just in a nutshell, Michelle, what goes into the whole thing since you've done this a couple of times?
I've done it for 3 years in a row now, so this will be my fourth year. And it's a pretty fun and exciting process. I just tend to kind of slowly gather things throughout the year and keep them in my garage into separate piles. And can when I wait for the theme to come out, once the theme's announced, then I kind of decide which pile best suits the theme of the upcoming year. So I have many projects in the wings just in
case. Do you
case.
Have any themes that we should be knowing about? That's always a hard part.
Yeah, that's always
you
a
You just
difficult.
Went down to help Sybil Davis in Burien to get
I did.
There.
I got invited by Sybil Davis, who is one of the founding members of the Jack Heron Juno, and she wanted to get this Wearable Art Runway show going, and she was quite amazed that down in the Seattle area that this wasn't already in existence. So what they're trying to do for their community, which she calls the Jack 30 years ago, is trying to get a runway show going down there. So they had a regular fundraiser event, kind of a wine and dine selling art and doing some silent auction stuff. And in the middle, we had a little impromptu runway show, which I brought down a couple of my pieces that I have from the previous years and invited a couple other local artists down there and kind of gave the crowd a bit of a shock, and they were really excited. They were pretty thrilled about it. So I think she's good to go for it and hopefully planted the seed in some people's heads down there. We gave them quite the right variety of what wearable art could be. And it really can be anything from true clothing, you know, made of cloth and denim and thread, but manipulated in a certain way and to make it very artful. So I had computer parts, and someone else actually wore real clothes. So it was good. It was fun.
And you went to Homer.
I didn't go to Homer. I sent my piece that won last year, People's Choice Award last year, my tarp dress. And I sent it to Homer, and they used it as one of their centerpieces in their wearable art show. I have been to the Anchorage Fiber Festival last year, with some pieces, and I've gotten some invites to the Ketchikan show as well.
Yeah, Ketchikan usually does their show the week before ours. They've been doing theirs almost as long as New Zealand has.
I think so. They're the starter one.
Yeah.
And, little plug for the WOW, having their exhibit travel to Seattle this coming summer.
Oh, it is. Oh.
So I just found that on Burien, so I am definitely planning a trip to Seattle next summer.
Are they bringing the Davy Walker one?
I don't know, but he has the headline on the WOW webpage. Like,
oh,
that's
wow.
That's the Gino plug right there.
Let's just, what would you say to encourage local artists who might want to try this? Really feeling a little scared.
What kind of recommendations did you have?
You can do whatever you want. I have seen so many things over the years. You can all skill levels encouraged. Children encouraged. Definitely, that we've got some really good middle school age students, high school age students that come every year. You don't have to know how to sew. You don't have to know any construction. Just go at it and. Have fun with it. That's the biggest thing, is to have fun. And if you're scared of being on the runway, find a friend who will do it for you, because you don't have to perform yourself. You can just stay behind the wings and dress somebody else up. And literally, it's 2 minutes. That's all you get on the runway stage. So if you can make it through 2 minutes, you're good to go.
And we do give everybody a lot of support with coaching
and all that sort of stuff.
So
there's DJ Manu helps with music selection and cutting music. You don't have to be a DJ to figure out your own music. And then, yes, there's runway modeling coaches that you will get 2 sessions or more if you want with modeling coaches, and they will help you kind of – and I am not a dancer or anything like that. And I come in, I said, here's the concept I have or the general idea, and they will give you moves, and they will help you practice.
It's really – I think it seems like – all the artists end up being a really wonderful family of people together.
Yes, the crew is very supportive. People who have never done it before will be helped. And certainly, like I said, I've only done it for 3 years. And when I first started, everyone else had so much encouragement. And everyone is always impressed to see what else is in the rooms behind the scenes.
It's inspirational.
It is. It's very Christmas-like, too, I think.
And the really wonderful part of it is how much it does for the community, because the money that we raise from Wearable Art supports the Individual Artist Grant Funds. It supports the Juno Arts and Humanities Council building, the Arts and Culture Center, and scholarships for kids. So it's really a nice thing, fun to do for the community. I hope you think that.
Oh, yeah, it's fun. It's definitely fun.
So I mean, how many times have you had an idea and worked with it for a little while and then discovered that it just wasn't working out like you wanted?
I've already done that this year, so it's definitely that's why I try to start a little bit early. I usually try and start around November and start playing around, because I usually use pretty unconventional materials. And things that you may have on paper or you may think in your head don't quite pan out once you start trying to assemble pieces together and you realize that's going to be way too heavy or that's not going to work, it's not going to fit through my door, you know, and then you start realizing, okay, I'm going to have to change, or this is going to take way too much time that I don't have. So,
any hints on what you got coming?
My hints for this year is my husband works at the fish pathology lab, and he's been gathering some lab supplies for me for a few years. So.
Super. Very cool. Yeah. I was just out there. Jeff, you used to do this for a while. Balloons.
That's right. Those are my milieu.
Your milieu, yes. Your genre or whatever. So it is open to, as you said, balloons and tarps.
Anything. Anything at all. You can use staples and glue and... As long as they can make it through 2 minutes or 4 minutes.
Those staples near my balloons.
Yeah. You got the two. I know that computer dress I had was pretty sharp. I had to stay away from certain people in the runway line.
Yeah. So I want to thank you for the contribution that you've made, and Jeff also for all that you've done for the arts and through this thing, and to encourage other people who might be interested, give us a call. Talk to Michelle, do whatever. But,
yeah, I'd love to help anybody. I mean, I just got started just watching the show in Juno, and it was inspirational to me for many years to watch and think, you know, you just have to make that first step. Just do the application, say, okay, I'm going to do it this year, and then go for it. And then it's addicting.
Yeah, it is addicting. I have had friends do it for, like, their 40th birthday or their 50th birthday or whatever. So
the deadline is coming up.
The deadline is on Wednesday by 5 o'clock. We need just all we need, really, you don't have to have it done, a drawing and sort of your basic ideas so we know what's going on, your music selection. We'll be ready for you.
Michelle Morris and Nancy DeJourney, thank you for coming by the station.
Thanks for having
thank
us.
Thank you.
Do you have a shirt that you really love? One that you feel so groovy in? You don't even mind if it starts to fray. That only makes it nicer still. I love my shirt. I love my shirt. My shirt is so comfortably lovely. I love my shirt. I love my shirt. My shirt is so comfortably lovely. Do you have some jeans that you really love? Ones that you feel so groovy in? You don't even mind if they start to fade. That only makes them nicer still. I love my jeans. I love my jeans. My jeans are so comfortably lovely. I love my jeans. I love my jeans. My jeans are so comfortably lovely. When I take them to the cleaners, I can't wait to get them home again. Yes, I take them to the cleaners. I'd rather wash them in a stream.
I'd rather wash them in a stream.
Know what I mean? Do you have some shoes that you really love?
46 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to Juno Afternoon. Our next guests are Don Hewitt and Brenda Bright here to talk about the Audubon Society's presentation all about Iceland. Thank you for coming by the station, everybody.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
So, Don, what about Iceland intrigues you?
Well, Iceland is such a place of contradictions. It's so far north to have a long habitation of Nordic people who have braved winters and volcanoes and separating continents.
When were you there?
The recent trip was in July and August of this year.
What's the misconception of people? I mean, I think Iceland has got to be covered with ice.
Right. Well, actually, Iceland is warmed by volcanoes and has lots of hot springs, and the southern and western sides have a broad plain where they have lots of sheep and grazing and farms.
And how long were you there?
Oh, we were there for 2 weeks this time.
What's your presentation going to consist of?
Well, we'll have about 100 images of hiking and backpacking and bicycle camping and watching birds. There were 4 of us from Juneau who went last summer. So it's kind of a summary of our trip, and I'm excited to let Juneau come along on our rambling.
What kind of birds did you see?
Well, we saw Atlantic puffins and auks and gulls, Atlantic loons and kittiwakes, and some that I'm hoping the more experienced birders in the group will help us identify.
And when is this talk?
It's going to be at 7 p.m. this Thursday at the UAS Recreation Center. That's the one across the road from the regular campus, room 116. And it's free and open to the public as usual.
All right. Anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
Well, you know, because we have a few extra jars left of jam from the public market, we're selling them at half price at the meeting, so come on down.
All right, thanks for coming by today.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
Dream, no request is too extreme.
It's about 10 minutes before the hour, and you're attuned to Listener Supported Public Media in Alaska's capital city. In the studio with me now is Rosemary Walling, here to talk about the planetarium production for tonight. It starts at 6:30. It's called Christmas in Space. Thank you for coming to the station, Rosemary.
Thank you.
So, Christmas in Space, it's not just looking up in the sky. Hubble telescope is going to be doing things.
Well, tonight's kind of a collage of various things, starting with just kind of some basics of Christmas being more or less a solstice holiday and what actually happens at solstice, where are we in space, then looking at just a little bit of history of what some things that NASA has done at Christmas time, and then probably the last two are the ones that I'm most interested in is what does Hubble Space Telescope do at Christmas, because a lot of times when you have large projects like that, people can get large chunks of viewing time. And there's a couple of really interesting things that Hubble has done in the past over the Christmas holidays. And so one of them is the Hubble Deep Field, which was their first look at the galaxy's farthest away. And they had no idea. They just pointed the telescope off at a blank area of space and had these amazing images that have come back. And so we'll have some fly-throughs of deep space through the Andromeda Nebula. And then also just kind of looking at what's happening at space at Christmas from this point of view of Hubble now is 25 years, and it's taken some incredible images of things that are millions and billions of light years away from us. And what that really means is that we see them as they were millions and billions of years in the past. So we can kind of get kind of an excuse to see what was going on at Christmas at various times in the very deep, distant past.
What is winter solstice?
A winter solstice is when the axis of the Earth, winter solstice for us occurs in December, and the northern axis of the Earth is pointing farthest away from the sun. And so the light that comes to the Earth is at an angle. We have our shortest days and so forth. And this year you could set your calendar. It's December 21st at 4:47 p.m. exactly. And that'll be when it's kind of at its pointing at its farthest away from us.
How did you get interested in astronomy?
I think I was interested in probably as a child in sort of the philosophical aspects of astronomy and cosmology. When I grew up, there was no data. And so things like astronomy and far distances and cosmology was very much as much philosophy as it was science. And in the amount of time since then, there's just an incredible amount of information that we've learned. So it's become a very precise science.
What goes on around Christmas time in space?
Well, everything that happens in space, not everything, but a lot of things that happen in space are very slow. So you could almost say what happens at Christmas time is also happening in other years, other parts of that year. And so when I think of what's happening at Christmas time, it's kind of an excuse just to look at some of the beautiful images that the Hubble Space Telescope has given us and understanding that those images that we see were as it was at a certain time in the past because they're a certain distance away from us. And so you could almost think of them like Christmas ornaments. If you could put them on a tree, it'd be one of the best Christmas trees ever.
And that starts at 6:30 tonight at the planetarium.
Right. Yeah.
And the planetarium is also raising money.
You know, we always take donations, but I thought I'd give a year of in plug because our Starball Planetarium is getting, I don't know, it may be around 50 years old now. It's getting up there. And we're trying to think about replacement projectors, and the commercial ones are really very expensive, but we have some ideas for taking fisheye lenses and some high-quality projectors and trying to make one of our own. Some other planetariums have done that. So I would just ask if anybody has particular expertise in optics, or if people have money that they would like to contribute to the planetarium, that they might want to consider it.
It was very willing. Thank you for coming down the stage.
Thank you.
Just a few minutes before the hour, and you are tuned in to listener-supported public media from Alaska's capital city. In the studio with me now is Leslie Knight. She's a junior Douglas High School teacher and a coach. She's here to talk about student activities. Leslie, thank you for coming down the station.
Yep, thank you for having us.
So what qualifies as student activities?
You know, a wide variety. Everything from sports to plays, music, drama and debate. We have the Interact Clubs. We have a club called Ignite. Probably 75% of students in the school district participate in these activities, and it's not just sports. A lot of times people think activities are sports.
What's so special about activities?
I think activities give kids a place to belong. Everyone wants to be a part of a group. It's an instant set of friends. They learn in their activities, whether it's in a classroom or out in the community or in a gym or on a field.
How many kids are involved? You said 75% of the kids in the high schools are involved in activities?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Our enrollments have gone down, and both schools are just over 600, and so the number they're saying is 75% are in some sort of activity. It's always an interesting dilemma whether we need so many activities, but obviously we're filling them. Is it more important to be participating, or is it more important to be competitive? I'm not sure. I think every kid has a niche, and there's a place for everybody.
How many activities? How do you decide what to add and subtract as far as activities?
You know, I don't have any say in that. I think what we look at a lot of times is funding, and activities don't cost money and can be created, that there's a process. We have advisors. Some are paid. Some are voluntary. I think the numbers coming out of the school district for Thunder Mountain are there are 34 different activities, and at JD there's currently 43. So there's a wide variety, and some of those have paid advisors, paid coaches, and some of them have fees to belong, and some do not.
What's the most popular activity?
Oh, that's hard to say. I think historically, you would probably say basketball in this town, because that's a long time history of, if you've been around long enough, you'll know that football, baseball, soccer, softball, some of those sports have been added through the years. They started out as club teams and then became high school affiliated sports. I think always the plays and the music department generate a lot of places for kids. Both schools have productions, and a large number of kids participate in that. So I would say historically it's been basketball programs and the play, theater, music.
Leslie, okay, thank you for coming down to the station today.
This is not really about party politics at all. At the core, it's not even about Muslims. It's about what kind of country America strives to be.
Reaction to Donald Trump's proposed ban on Muslims entering the U.S. For Tuesday, December 8th, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish. Coming up, Republicans respond to Trump's latest remarks. We speak to the chairman of the Republican Party.